Hello and welcome to the Squawker Talker. My name is Sam Long and today I'm joined by assistant editor Jake Entwistle. How's it going, Jake?
Yeah, it's going very well. Champions League week beginning, so I'm excited about today.
Chief writer Mohammed Butt is also here. How's it going, Mo?
Pretty good as always. You know, I have to have my catchphrase. So Champions League! Here we go.
So, mentioning Champions League, we're actually going to start with the Premier League. New pace setters Chelsea. Fresh from his hat-trick against Cardiff, I want to know how many goals do we think Eden Hazard can score this season and what does he need to do to reach Mario Sarri's 40-goal target?
I know, 40 goals is a big target.
It's a big number.
Set, but Maurizio Sarri, I saw a tweet from a previous Squawker legend, Ollie Young-Miles, today, saying that if anyone's going to help a player crack their personal goal record, it's Maurizio Sarri, because he helped Higuain absolutely obliterate a Serie A record when he was at Napoli, and he converted Dries Mertens into 25 plus goal a season player. So it looks like Hazard's going to be his little mission this season to get him above. He's never scored 20 goals across all competitions for Chelsea in a season, so he looks well on course to do that considering he's a top scorer of the Premier League. 5 goals already, and I think the main reason why he got that hat-trick was Olivier Giroud was playing up front next to him. Eden Hazard is a brilliant carrier of the ball, but there's some times where you can't carry it past all 11 players. And what he's got in Olivier Giroud is when he's stumbling and he's maybe losing a bit of balance, which for Eden Hazard is very rare, he's got probably the most handsome and also the best wall pass in European football standing in front of
him. That is a beautiful wall, man.
Yeah, exactly. Not many walls are going to be looking like that, but it's just, you saw it. Even if Giroud himself is falling into two defenders and doesn't look that sort of brilliant or aesthetically pleasing the way he links it up, he leans into defenders so well when he directs the ball back to Hazard, and Hazard can continue his run, regain his balance and work his way into the box and finish. I think you saw that mostly for the second goal where Hazard literally poked it into Giroud, or it might have been someone else, and Giroud fell backwards and just turned it around the corner. Hazard picked it up. There was a deflection on the goal, but that sort of thing is only going to happen more and more if they play together. So I think Morata, even at Hazard, said, didn't he? He said, Morata's a good forward, but he's completely different to Giroud. And I think if you want to make Hazard your main man, then Olivier Giroud has to be the forward for Sarri, because he enables Eden Hazard to do even more than he's already capable of.
I mean, yeah, this is the thing with Hazard, is my big... I mean, first off, it's a good job no one here picked Eden Hazard for flop of the season, I'll tell you that. Because if anyone did that, boy, they'd be feeling pretty stupid right about now. Look, this is my whole thing with Eden Hazard was he never was ruthless enough in front of goal, because it's such a stupid criticism to make of a player who is so obviously good, who has been so obviously good for so long. But I always just thought, this guy could absolutely obliterate the Premier League. He could be the best player in the Premier League by a distance. He has been the best player in the Premier League before, but like I'm talking about, like, he could be that sort of Cristiano Ronaldo level of just like absolutely smashing opponents and being an unstoppable force. And it always bugged me that he almost wasn't. And it's such a petty gripe. But this season we're seeing exactly what he can. This is it. Now he's 27. He's in his, you know, the classic peak of a forward player. You know, when your positional intelligence is really good, your physical, you're not quite physical peak, but you're still physically dominant. And he's got a coach. He's got the dream coach for him. Because this is the thing. All his other coaches, Mourinho, Ancelotti is attacking but doesn't really focus on anything individually. Hiddink, Mourinho, Conte, these guys are defensive coaches. They'll give you some sort of attacking structure, but nothing too amazing. Sarri is an offensive coach. His first protocol is, okay, how can I make this guy, who's my best player? Okay, Eden Hazard. How can I make this guy score all the goals in the world? And he's already figured out how to do it. You work less defensively, you spend more energy, you spend more time closer to the goal, you spend more energy when you're dribbling the ball. That immediately keeps you fresher to attack. Then you play, who can I play up front? Oh, do I play the guy who's actually probably going to score more goals individually, Morata? Or do I play this guy who's going to just absolutely be a perfect, like, target man, assister, creator for Eden Hazard, to get Eden Hazard to score 40 goals? And of course, let's not forget, Giroud can also score goals himself. He didn't do it the weekend, but he's very capable of chipping in with goals himself. And I think that's the no-brainer. And the only thing that bugs me is that Giroud's wearing 18 still, not number 9. Like, the 9 was free. Take it, Olivier.
Well, wasn't free when they signed him, was it?
No, but
Morata
once Morata swapped it, he should have been, right, anyway. I'm having that, mate. He should have moved across to have it, because 9 and 10, classic partnership. It is a classic partnership. It's a little and large. I know they're playing in a front three, but it's a little and large front partnership, and then you've got the number 11 on the other side. It's a beautifully numbered front three, if it could be. And role-wise, it's perfect, because Pedro is the perfect counterbalance to those two, because he's constantly moving off the ball, looking for spaces. And Hazard has always been very unselfish for Chelsea. And now he can still do that now, because now he'll have Pedro constantly on the offer somewhere away from the ball. So if Hazard and Giroud drawing a bit too much heat to each other, they can then just flick it out to Pedro. And Pedro had a lot of the ball. A lot of the chances and half chances Chelsea had at the weekend were Pedro in a lot of space doing something. Now, nothing came off. But you can already see the pattern of play emerging. Like, obviously, with Sadi before, most of the creativity has come from the left wing, and most of the goals have come from the striker, or false nine, if that's Dries Mertens. Now what you're seeing is almost like the left winger and the striker are going to act in symbiosis, and the left winger will score most of the goals. Goal scorer will create most of the chances. And I just think... I think Hazard's going to score 38 goals. I think he's going to fall short of the 40. I think he's going to score 38. I don't know why I think 38. Just that number pops into my head.
I think 38 is difficult, because I don't think he's going to play any of the Europa League.
Well, maybe not, but I think that will help him. I think that will help him stay fit for the Premier League.
So that means think he's going to break Salah's record?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I think, I'm sorry. This guy is genuinely something else. And unlike Mohamed Salah, who takes penalties. If Mohamed Salah took Liverpool's penalties, he would have had, 38 goals? How many did Milner score last season?
Not many. They didn't have many penalties in the Premier League. No. And Salah did take a couple and missed one.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
But with Hazard saying that Giroud's best target man in the world, it's hard to argue.
He's not wrong. I mean, if you're talking about pure, like, hold the ball up, playing your teammates.
Link play, look at it. Yeah. Again, someone was drawing comparisons about how he completely unlocked Griezmann in Euro 2016.
Yeah, I mean...
He wasn't necessarily the same enabler at the World Cup. But you've got this guy that when it wasn't the same.
Yeah,
way.
It was a different system at the World Cup. It wasn't,
they were more reserved, so he became a midfielder. But you've Olivier Giroud, any team you play him in, he individually will not score you 40 goals.
Yeah.
But if you play him in a good team, he can make every other player around him score 40 goals.
Yeah,
he created four chances against Cardiff, and that was the most in the Chelsea team. He picked up two assists already. It wouldn't surprise me if Olivier Giroud gets into a double-double this season. Quite low scoring, but if he gets 15 goals, 10 assists, that is exactly what you want from a link man when you've got Hazard.
I mean,
we're expecting to get 30-plus.
I would bank on more than 10 assists from Giroud, to be honest. Just on the evidence of yesterday, I would look at 15, maybe 15-plus.
Well, that's like De Bruyne got 16 last season.
Yeah, but then De Bruyne also was playing a team with multiple weapons. I think he's going to be the primary protocol for Hazard to get assists. Like, those wall passes are just... You think about how many times Hazard dribbles in and he just needs a wall pass to get open.
Well, it's like Messi, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And actually, that's what I was going to say. The only other striker that I've seen be this potently creative is Luis Suarez. And Suarez obviously has fallen off now. And I think it's quite fitting almost that Giroud is sort of ascending to this next level. I mean, he's always been an amazing playmaker, creator. But I think it's quite fun that he's ascending to this next level of creativity as Suarez is sort of like dwindling and falling off. So it's like, we have a new king, a new playmaking king of forwards, you know, it's Olivier Giroud.
It's not even playmaking, it's just,
just creativity, little flick. That is, though, isn't it? That just that ability to, like, little five-yard passes. The five-yard passes inside the box are the hardest passes to make.
Deftest touch and he in does the Premier them, League.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And I think it's such a good buy. Such a good buy? What was that? Such a good system, such a good setup they have.
Okay, moving on from that then, we've got a question from a listener, George Barrows. Mm. And he wants to know, why is David Luiz still playing ahead of Andreas Christensen? And if Chelsea can be more solid at the back, can they challenge for the title?
He's still playing ahead of Christensen because he's a better footballer. He's better with the ball at his feet. And it's simple as that. In Sadi's system, Sadi's mode, you know, you prioritise ball playing, you prioritise building out from the back. And David Luiz is streets ahead of Andreas Christensen in that form. It's simply that good.
That's what I mean. If they're scoring four every game, then David Luiz having defensive mistakes, you're not bothered, because what he's adding to those, clipping those balls out to each wing, as Mo said, he does that better than any Chelsea defender. So it's worth the risk. Obviously, as we're aware, Christensen is very tidy on the ball, but he's very much, he won't lose it. David Luiz will take a risk every time he's on the ball, and that can be a burden sometimes. But Christensen, I imagine, will get lots of minutes in the Europa League. Like we said before on last week's podcast, him and Ampadu could be a great partnership to develop. But at the moment, you've just become the fourth manager to win your first five games. following in Cray Shakespeare's iconic footsteps. They don't need to change the defence at the moment. And yeah, David Luiz is a risk taker. And quite simply, it's that's what Sarri wants. He wants people that can win games with the ball, not necessarily avoid losing games when they're off it.
Yeah, I mean, the big question is, can Chelsea win the Premier League? It does kind of depend on two things. One is, can Eden Hazard be a consistent goal scorer? Because the one thing you would say with Olivier Giroud is he's not, in the Premier League, going to score you enough goals to win a title. But if he can score you 10, 15 goals and then suddenly start creating for Eden Hazard, I think maybe, yeah, then you're looking at, then maybe you have enough goals. And then defensively, yeah, can David Luiz against better teams hold it? Chelsea have had a relatively easy ride, I think.
Look at the game against Arsenal. That could have been 9-0.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's like they've had a relatively easy go of things in terms of fixtures. They've not really had anyone testing them too much. Cardiff even scored first. And they had a few chances. So, but the thing with Chelsea is you can't get more defensively solid unless they've signed a left-back to replace Alonso. And I don't think they would want to do that because he's so important to their attacks. It's the risk you carry with Sadi, right? This is the and if their attack can keep on scoring goals, they can outscore a bunch of teams and be in the mix. I don't think you can ever really sort of quote unquote improve the defense in that sort of way.
It's the nature, isn't it?
It's just the way he's. That's why Napoli always struggled to win the league because that you can't change the defense too much because then it's like you lose what makes the whole team tick.
His Napoli's defensive record actually last season was good, but that's purely born out of having so much of the ball rather than being good defensively. If you look at Juventus, Atletico Madrid, even Man United last season, their defensive records were born out of the fact that their defence and their goalkeeper was brilliant. Napoli don't concede goals because most teams only get 15% of the ball. So it works in a different way. And David Luiz, although he said Christensen will give you 99% pass accuracy, David Luiz is in the team because he can get assists. Sarri wants everyone in his team to be able to play a killer pass. Alonso can score a killer goal, make a killer cross. Azpilicueta's got that classic edge of the 6-yard box, 18-yard box cross. Everyone in that team could get an assist realistically. And from Christensen, we haven't necessarily seen that yet. So at the moment in the Premier League, 5 wins from 5, Chelsea look impressive. They look like they're finding their patterns, as Mo said. And in Giroud and Hazard, they could have one of the most exciting partnerships in the Premier League this season.
Absolutely. So up next is the Wilfried Zaha situation. He made some very bold statements after Palace's win at Huddersfield, suggesting he would need to have his leg broken before being treated differently by officials. So do we think he's right? Do the more skillful and attacking players need more protection from referees?
Yeah, absolutely. I 110%. Like you just that's been the biggest knock against the Premier League and why it's almost, until literally very recently, it's found it hard to attract like true top-tier skillful attacking talent, because who wants to come to the Premier League and get the living bejesus kicked out of your ankles and then not have the referees give you anything? I still remember Memphis Depay when he came over from the Netherlands. And, I mean, he had other issues as well, Memphis. But I remember one of the big things he had was he would constantly go into 50-50s in the Eredivisie and he would blow past people. Or sometimes defenders would get angry and just push him over. And whenever that happened, he'd get a foul, he'd get a free kick. When he played in the Premier League, whenever he would blow past defender and they'd just push him over, referees wouldn't give him a free kick. And he spent so much of his first few games just sitting on the floor going, "Hey, ref." And the referee would just let play on because that's the way the Premier League is. Now, that's not violent tackles or anything, but that's just an example of the way the physicality is venerated in the Premier League, and that often blows back against really skillful players. Think about how often Cristiano Ronaldo, when he was here, got the living bejesus kicked out of him. Hazard is constantly getting fouled.
Yeah, but look how much better it made Cristiano Ronaldo for that, though.
Yeah, well, you say that, but then that's fine, it made Cristiano Ronaldo better. How many other players did it ruin? How many other players did it knock back or discourage? Look at Jose, look at Reyes, for example. Look at how Robin didn't really thrive until he left England. Had to get away from the brutality of the Premier League. Then suddenly goes to Real Madrid, plays for Bayern Munich, and he's magnificent because there in the Bundesliga and especially in La Liga, attacking talent is protected. A lot of people argue that it's soft and this and that, but ultimately there is a reason all the best attacking players in the world play in La Liga. It's because they look after attacking players. The referees don't let you just you can brutalize people, but you'll get called for it. That's the simple thing.
I think with Zaha's situation as well, it's not like people are winning the ball. The Capu tackle was like awful last week. He'd literally gone past him, and Capu just put all 8 studs on his Achilles. That is how you're not getting sent off for that is ridiculous. And I think it's because referees are, because of what the red card brings is you lessen the game. I think it affects the game so much. Even mentally, you think, if I send someone off here, that's now 10-11.
It's almost like I'll ruin the
game.
Yeah,
I'll ruin the game, and that's obviously a bad. And I think that comes from pressure or from sort of the media and people that consume football, because if any red card's given, and any half-time analysis always, oh, the refs ruined the game here, isn't it? That's always, it's not, I'm so glad he got sent off because he's going to break someone's leg soon. And it's why Neymar is sort of the villain of the piece as well, because yes, he makes everything look really dramatic, but he gets kicked to absolute SH. I won't finish the word. It's ridiculous, though, and that's why the most foul players, or the people that win the most fouls, are these wingers. I think Richarlison is actually up there with winning the most fouls. I think he's had 100 since he's joined the Premier League, bang on 100. And sometimes, yes, they are sort of dives, and they're very, you're conning the referee, but most of the time he does that because Richarlison is a physical forward. And if he controls the ball and someone just swipes at his ankles from behind, why shouldn't he feel the need to go down?
Yeah, and it's you know, you just, it's just, it's so important to protect and culture and push these. I mean, we'll talk about more in a later section, but there's kind of a reason why a lot of these young skillful English forwards are going somewhere else and in Europe, in the Bundesliga, and actually thriving. And this is part of the reason, because if you stay in the Premier League, you just get kicked to, ever, you know, to end it to business. And yeah, okay, sometimes you'll get a player like Cristiano Ronaldo who has the psychopathic self-determination to push through all that and become great anyway. But a lot of players just get sort of put off by it, because honestly, you would. It's like, if you just keep getting kicked, you're going to stop making those runs, stop trying to do those skills, because it hurts, man. And I mean, eventually you're going to get injured, and it's going to be a serious problem.
I think it's a fine line to sort of always side with the creative player. I don't think it's a bad thing if there's defenders who are trying to use it to their advantage.
I don't think there's anything wrong with that. What I'm saying is, tough tackles are obviously not a problem. That is part of it. You can win the ball cleanly. It's when people run past and players get kicked, and that's somehow a yellow card. So whether that is not seen as a red card, whether something should be introduced to deter that behaviour, it's not. I'm not talking about don't go up for headers. Don't slide tackle. Obviously, that's not part of it. You can make slide tackling an art as much as you can taking someone on. You can do it well. You can not injure the player, but you can make yourself known to an attacker. What is wrong is when Zaha takes people on, literally gets booted in the ankles, and either doesn't even get a foul, the player doesn't even get booked, or worse, when he's getting his Achilles stood on, there's not a red card.
It's the lack of censure. That's the main thing, because ultimately, players are going to be there. Like, look, again, to bring back La Liga, look at Sergio Ramos. The guy loves a tackle, really violent player. But when he how many red cards has he got?
Exactly.
You know, it's like, so when you do that, you get punished. You know what I mean? It's like that. And Sergio Ramos is a massive icon of La Liga, of Real Madrid, Champions League winner, hero. The guy still gets red carded when he does stupid stuff. It's like, and that's the kind of attitude. Okay, fine, look, players are going to be flying in physical tackles. You don't want to sort of, you know, I mean, you do want to discourage the really physical stuff, but you don't want to be like, don't defend, don't use your physicality, but punish them. And this is, I mean, look at the most absurdly violent World Cup final in recent memory, Spain versus Netherlands. Why was it violent? Because there was an English dude refereeing the game. And he was like, yeah, go on, yeah, you can, Nigel Dorn, you can kung fu kick Xabi Alonso in the chest. Yeah, that's fine, that's nothing.
Yeah, but yeah. I would say that was mainly because of the reason that Jake said earlier, where he felt he was going to ruin the game.
Yeah, that's where we need to. That's what I'm saying is, should there be a sin bin? Yeah. Should there be like, I mean, okay, that's not a red card, but you've booted him in the shin. You need to have 5 minutes off, mate.
I think what the Zaha situation highlights is how difficult it can be to shake a reputation once you've got it, because it's definitely in the minds of all the referees that Zaha is the one they need to look out for. All the fans are obviously on his back because he's Palace's main man.
Yeah.
And it's like, once you have that reputation, like, how do you shake that? So he's picked up, I think he's the most booked player for simulation in the past three seasons. But then what gets forgotten is, did he deserve those bookings for all those bookings?
I understand why he is the way he is and why he plays the way he plays, to be honest. Because it's like, again, he gets no protection from referees. And ultimately, part of diving, obviously, is trying to con the referee. Part of it is just to protect yourself half the time. If you look at the way some of these dives happen, he's just jumping out of the way of a guy, 6'4" guy, trying to snap his ankles in half. And it's this. And again, to bring it back to that World Cup final, how Webb has said since on a Squawker podcast, I do believe, that he didn't give those red cards because he didn't want to ruin the final. And I mean, you know, he's admitted that, and that was fine. But that's still a problem. The fact that could even enter into his thought process. He's there to enforce the rules, and the rules should have said the Dutch should have had like 4 red cards in that first half. But the thing is, everyone said, oh, he would have ruined the game. No, because if he just issues one, the Dutch will back off.
Yeah.
The whole point was they knew he wasn't going to send them off. They kept on doing it. And that's the thing. Physical side test the referee. Mm. They always go hard. All and this is the clever thing. And going back to change sports in the NFL, there was Seattle Seahawks were the best defensive side for years, right? Not currently right now, but they had this thing called the Legion of Boom. These really big physical defenders. And what they did was they would hold their opponents on every single play, defensive holding, because they knew the refs are not going to flag us on every single play for defensive holding. So they did it just basically all the time. And then they basically and got away with it because the refs aren't going to be like, oh, holding, 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 because that will be ruining the game, quote unquote.
But that comes into with all this pushing in the penalty area. Yeah. And there are things that obviously will get penalised more often than not. But what I sort of want to emphasise here is we're not saying, oh, stop everyone tackling in football.
Yeah.
It's like referees need to... And I don't think it's on them. As I said, it's not their thing. Being a referee must be one of the most horrible experiences in the world, really. When you're on the pitch and if it's a big game and someone's just booted someone in the shin, and that does enter your mind. It's like, I'm about to get rid of a player.
Yeah.
I can't undo this. What needs to happen is they need to have the confidence to enforce the rules properly. If someone's getting kicked, sort them out so no one gets kicked again. Yeah,
it's on the FA.
And that's what I mean. People like Zaha get angry and then they lash out because they're getting kicked four times, not even one yellow card's been issued. And then he gets one for when he lashes out. So it's that sort of balance of not being scared of enforcing the laws properly. It's not saying tighten up the laws or make every tackle yellow card. It's when there is a yellow card and there is a red card, make sure it's given.
So moving on to Liverpool, who beat Spurs 2-1 but really should have been outside. Wijnaldum and Milner were both brilliant, and I want to know if you think that their performances are a threat to Jordan Henderson's place in the side.
Yeah, I mean, he's basically... I know Klopp said that he's... or hinted at that he's resting Henderson with the Champions League in mind, but you look at Liverpool, and he's definitely their third best defensive midfielder, and he's even their best box-to-box midfielder now, because Naby Keita is better than him in every position, right? And then... you know, you figured, okay, well, he only had Fabinho to contain with. Oh, Fabinho's not settling very quickly. Well, that gives Henderson half a season or so to prove his worth in the Premier League. But now it's like, no. Wijnaldum is coming. Wijnaldum is... Look, Fabinho is their best defensive midfielder, like actual defending. But with the ball, obviously Henderson offers something that no one else does with his long passing. But Wijnaldum actually helps them keep the ball and helps them rotate the ball and move it. And often for the way they play... that's better. Like, I mean, they're not a possession side or anything, but just having someone who can zip the ball to Naby Keita, to James Milner, up to the fullbacks, whatever, is often better than someone who, like Henderson, can launch it to the forwards. Okay, fair enough. But then also is going to be exposed mobility-wise, positional-wise, defensively. And I think, yeah, Henderson is... I mean, he may get back in the side just because he's the captain and everyone loves him and everything. He is a hard worker. But quality-wise, I mean, you can't argue. I would pick Wijnaldum over him every day. And yeah, as you said as well, James Milner in the box-to-box role is in the third man role.
He's now... James Milner in this Liverpool side now is combining all of his experiences in every position he's played, and he's now found a position where he can use it all at once.
Yeah.
In the first 10 minutes of that Liverpool game, how many crosses did he put in that were inch-perfect? Oh, he used to be a winger. And then as the game progressed, what was he doing? Tracking back, winning tackles, sort of in a fullback-esque manner, covering for Alexander-Arnold, who absolutely drives forward. And on the point about Henderson's distribution there, what you don't realise as well, and why Wijnaldum is now useful in playing these short passes, he's actually the only Liverpool player since the start of last season to average above 90% pass accuracy. And again, that's what we always say England are missing, and it's so valuable. But why you don't miss Henderson's distribution is because you've got a 19-year-old that plays right back who can do it just as well.
Mm.
So Wijnaldum now, rather than him having to unleash this front three... he can look to Robertson, who's bombing forward, working with Keita, or he can look wide to Milner and Robertson on Alexander-Arnold and that right, who both have the ability to play the balls that Henderson does. But now what they've got is a more dynamic number six in Wijnaldum. Obviously, he started as a number 10, was scoring goals for Newcastle all at home, albeit, then moved into sort of the box-to-box role that you see Keita and Milner in now. And because of those two working now, he's now the number six, waiting for Fabinho to develop and while Jordan Henderson's getting fit. So it's an absolute testament to Wijnaldum that Klopp's used him in so many different roles, and he's been very good in all of them, and he might have just found his best one now. Also a massive testament to Milner being able to combine all of those skills throughout the years, and now you can't take Milner out of that team at the moment. No, you can't. There's no reason or any explanation why Milner would be dropped apart from not being fit. And when is Milner not fit? I don't think I've ever seen him on the bench. So that midfield at the moment, Keita, Milner, Wijnaldum, is probably Liverpool's best midfield. And it's going to take a lot for Henderson and Fabinho, who we haven't even seen play a minute yet, break into that team.
Mm. So on the other side of the pond, Zlatan Ibrahimovic joined the 500 club in style with a roundhouse kick against Toronto.
Absolutely ridiculous. Yes, just a stunning goal.
Lionel Messi and Cristiano Ronaldo are the only other active players with 500 plus goals. So do we think we will see three goal scorers like this at once ever again?
Yeah, absolutely. Because we've seen this before, albeit it was in the 50s and 60s.
Well, because that's what I mean. So we're not going to see it again, are we?
No, we will. We'll just be old men. It's just, look, it was Pelé had, in the 50s and 60s, Pelé, 643 goals he ended on, career goals. Puskas, 622. Eusebio, 580. And that's just club goals. It's not including their international goals. Each of them would be even higher with international goals. So yeah, but that was in the late 50s, mid-60s, and early 60s, and then Pelé in the 70s as well.
2040.
Yeah, basically. And, you know, and it will happen. It's a very
freak. It's going to be over by then.
It's a very, very freak thing to have players this good playing concurrently. I mean, in the 60s, they also had Di Stefano, and who was just shy of 500 goals. So, you know, it's it will happen again, but it's a very rare confluence of events. Like, to have Messi and Cristiano, these two of them at the same, but then to have Zlatan sort of bubbling away in the background, like, because everyone forgot about the fact that it's funny, because obviously you look at what Zlatan's achieved, especially since turning 30, which is almost more impressive. Yeah. And you would, like, in any other era, he'd be the headline act, but now he's not the second, he's third fiddle, even fourth, really.
Yeah, in terms of goals, he's third fiddle, but he's 37.
Yeah, and it's actually funny as well, because you look at the ages, I mean. Messi and Cristiano are both over 100 goals ahead of Zlatan, and they're both younger than he is, which is, I think that's pointing out. But, you know, Zlatan, he's had an amazing career, right? He started off slowly in a sort, you know, didn't score loads of goals, and he went to Barcelona and scored a fair amount and should have really gone supernova there, but his attitude didn't mesh with Pep. So then he went to Milan, but he really found his home in Paris. You know, in PSG, he really sort of, he made that his club, he made them a winning club, gave them a winning mentality. You know, he returned. I would honestly credit him more than Mourinho for turning Man United back into a relevant team again. I think if you look at United, they were at their best in this under Mourinho. They're at their best when Zlatan was fit. When he dropped off and got injured, they've not been the same since then. So he's had an amazing career. That was an amazing goal, an absolutely incredible way to score your 500th career goal. I can't imagine.
Well, it's the most Zlatan finish he could have done. Like, what? How many unique finishes in those 500 goals do you reckon there are, of where it's just complete mind-bending athleticism?
Yeah.
And I think that is the key part. These three players, all of them are absolute freaks of nature. Zlatan Ibrahimovic to have torn his cruciate ligament and then do that in a game at 37 years old next week or in October, not going to see a footballer like that again.
Yeah.
Until you look at Cristiano Ronaldo, who, again, at 33 years old, has got the athleticism of a 22-year-old apparently in peak physical condition.
630 career goals.
Yeah. And then you've got the Lionel Messi, who's probably the most naturally gifted player, or definitely I've ever seen. Again, the arguments about in history of football. But on this day, actually, as well, it was in 2000, he first went to Barcelona. And obviously, you look at the pictures of him there and you think, how is this scrawny little kid ever going to become the most... score the most goals in La Liga, score the most goals for them in total, win the most trophies at the club, and he's not even finished yet. This is the thing, his career now, and that's the thing with Zlatan, his post-30-year-old career, assign that to any player in the world, they'd take that already. What he's achieved after 30 is phenomenal.
Interesting with Ronaldo, he's probably going to go and do an MLS or something.
Yeah. Oh, he will score 37. So many goals.
Well, Beckham's going to get Messi to do it as well.
Yeah. Well, that's the Adidas thing, isn't it? It's like, hey, come on.
Griezmann and Messi for Inter Miami. But yeah, so maybe we'll see the goal scoring numbers again. Maybe football will develop in another way where everyone's pumping 7 goals a game. But in terms of seeing three human beings in the footballing world that are like this, I don't even think you can call them humans. That Zlatan Ibrahimovic goal was the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen a 37-year-old do.
To even think of it was pretty incredible.
That's what I mean. Ronaldo can't do that. Ronaldo can't put his would his overhead kick against Juventus was incredible athleticism. Like, you see that leap. Ronaldo's always had that leap. But Ibrahimovic doesn't need to jump because he can get his foot 9 foot in the air.
Yeah. Like Zlatan, Cristiano would have headed that ball. Messi would have just sort of watched it go over his head and been like, oh, what am I supposed to do with that? Or he would have caught it on the volley or something. Yeah. He would have dropped back and catch it on the volley. Yeah, Cristiano would have jumped up and headed it, probably scored as well. Yeah. but to do what normal players would... I mean, it sounds weird to say this because obviously those other two are better than him, but normal players would have done what Messi did, drop back and catch it on the volley or something, or jump up and head it like Cristiano did. No one would think, I'm just going to kick this. And it's just... And the fact that he did it and the fact that it worked was so good. And also, I think the fact that they were losing 3-0 and it was 3-1, and actually, ultimately, it wasn't like...
they lost,
didn't
they?
I think that's more than anything sums up Zlatan, like the sort of unfortunate genius of this guy, and yet no one ever... Like, it's just almost forgotten how good he actually is because... He's constantly either been second fiddle to someone. So like when he was at Juve, he was second fiddle to Trezeguet and to Del Piero. And then when he went to Barcelona, second fiddle to Messi. Or he's done it in leagues where people not necessarily didn't all have all eyes on him. So when Serie A was in decline, Milan when Serie A was in decline, PSG when no one was paying attention to Paris, and now MLS. It's the unfortunate... It's like a weird tragedy for Zlatan, really, because he's...
But that's what I mean. What people shouldn't forget, and also he's so outspoken and so rogue with his quotes saying Toronto were his 500th victim and all this. Like, in terms of a personality, we're unlikely to see someone like that again that speaks so much rubbish, really. But also, but it is fun to an extent. But
he's basically a wrestler.
Yeah, it shouldn't be forgotten how talented he is. And as I said, I can't emphasize enough how ridiculous that finish was. And as I said, Mo said, in maybe 50 years' time, we'll see three people concurrently on 500 goals, but we will not see three players like this ever again.
Cool. So next up, we have the Bundesliga Brits. Obviously, several young players are over-thriving in Germany. So do we think the Premier League is too cutthroat for young players to get a chance? So the likes of Loftus-Cheek, Foden and Solanke, do they need to move?
I mean, yeah, that's what I was saying earlier. It is. Physically, it's very physical, not just in terms of tackles, but also in terms of just the relentlessness of the play. It's constant up and down, up and down, up and down. And some players are built for that. Some players can thrive in that. Defenders, obviously, Premier League does produce a lot of very good young defenders, partly because they're constantly getting worked, you know? But it's very hard for attacking players to come and young attacking players to come and learn how to thrive. There are obviously exceptions, and I do think Phil Foden is in one of the few places where it's good to be. So if you're playing for Pep Guardiola, you're playing for Maurizio Pochettino, I think you're okay. You'll be fine, by and large. But the majority of other players, if you're not playing for those two, you know, it's not going to happen, is it? It's much harder. Look, Reece Nelson is absurdly talented. Like, we saw that goal in training. How long was that? 2 years ago now?
Well, yeah. He's had two really good preseasons with Arsenal, and they're not converted.
And just not played at all. Arsene Wenger played him as a wing back, which is just... I remember watching those games. I was covering them for Squawk, and I just remember thinking, he's really good. Why is he a wing back? Put him in the middle. And it was just absurd.
It was because at the time, in that Europa League, Walcott had to play, Giroud had to play, and Welbeck had to play.
He was rehabbing Wilshere as well, basically through the Europa League, which worked for Wilshere, but it was just frustrating.
And what you'd say about Wenger there is, at least at that time, Reece Nelson got that platform for some minutes.
Yeah, he played some minutes.
But every time, as you said, every time you watch that game, it was clear that Reece Nelson was better on the ball.
Yeah.
Theo Walcott has obviously got incredible pace, natural finishing ability. Not saying he's a better player necessarily, but on the ball, Reece Nelson was better than Walcott.
Yeah, absolutely.
At dribbling. And now he gets, in the Bundesliga, 14 minutes, one shot, one goal.
Yeah.
He's playing for Hoffenheim, got the number 9 shirt. Serge Gnabry did the same move, Hoffenheim. He's now at Bayern Munich.
Jadon Sancho is unreal.
Since he joined Dortmund, he's their leading assist provider in the Bundesliga.
He's got 7 assists in all competitions for Dortmund. 7 assists in 16 games. 7 starts. That's absurd. Yeah. 7 assists.
That's what I mean. In the Bundesliga, it's 7. And this is the thing where you have to tread a bit carefully. We're saying, like, give minutes and stuff. Jadon Sancho, in a season and a bit, has played 720 minutes. That's actually not a lot.
No.
So we need to be careful to be saying Jadon Sancho's out there, he's just played a 38-game season, looks like a world beater. But he's coming on and he's making an impact.
That's the thing. It's intelligent use of them. I mean, you know, Nelson came off the bench, but it was in a league game.
Yeah.
And it was in a game that actually had something at stake.
They were losing, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. There was something at stake. It was an important game. And that's, you know, again, we're not saying let's throw all these 18-year-olds in to start them all. Because, again, most 18-year-olds physically can't handle that, even in the Bundesliga. But you bring them in, you bring them through, you use them. 700 minutes for Jadon Sancho. He wouldn't have played that at Man City. He wouldn't have done that. And then, you know, he'll play more and more, and he's gradually being built up into a starting player. And you see how effective he is off the bench. He'll then learn to be effective from the start. Reece Nelson, same thing. And I mean, Nelson obviously got a lot of minutes for Arsenal, but it was, again, that's actually a really good example, because he got a lot of minutes for Arsenal in the Europa League, but it was they were bad minutes almost.
Yeah.
Because it was just wing back, so he's spending most of his time defending. Is that really developing him? You know, Maitland-Niles is another great example. He's a really good midfielder. He was playing fullback for most of the
that
time.
That was purely out of him being versatile. He was a victim of versatility because it was like Arsenal don't have a left back that exists.
Yeah,
but Maitland-Niles were very talented.
I mean, it sounds like I'm ripping on Arsenal, and only because I remember watching some of those Europa League games, and like they had so many good young talents, man. Joe Willock is another one. I really like Joe Willock, and he's just sort of fallen off. And part of it is, I think, lack of development. As again, I don't mean Arsenal should be giving these guys 90 minutes, but 20 minutes every other game, every week in the Premier League. That's really significant.
And then when they start, make sure they're starting in there.
Yeah,
in
exactly. Their role. And yeah, in their significant minutes in actual league competition and in their position, not just bringing them on wherever, whenever. And I mean, you compare that. Obviously, I mean, that kind of dovetails in nicely with the way Mourinho's recent rant about Rashford. And it's like, oh, I played him this many minutes, three finals, you know, and it's like, yeah, okay, Jose, but how many of those minutes were in left wing where he had most of his time defending at left back? Most of them, I would imagine. Like, how many minutes did he actually play up front in a proper team where, you know, actually attacking team? And it's like, I don't know how many it is off my hand. I wish I'd gone back and just counted it, because I guarantee it's less than 10. Less than 10 games up front. And that's a really good counterexample. You know, it's like he needs to be playing in his proper position every week, you know, and he's physically ready to play, not every week, but most weeks, you know, unlike Sancho and Linus Nelson, who are still teenagers.
There's one player that is now considered one of the best in the world that went through that exact path. And Leonardo Jardim needs huge amount of credit for how he introduced Mbappe into that team. Mbappe, in that 2016-17 season, just come back from being the best player at the under-19 Euros, had a bit of an injury which slowed it. But in that team with Silva, Lamar, all those young players that were starting because they were 21, 22, Mbappe just kept coming off the bench, half an hour, goal, half an hour, goal. And then Mbappe played up front with Falcao for the second half of the season and tore the Champions League apart. But the slow introduction, we're not asking managers to be like, get rid of all your good players and play all these teenagers. It's when you are 4-1 up against Cardiff, give Loftus-Cheek that 30 minutes in the role he wants to play it. And then if you don't believe he can do it, then let him move on. Don't stockpile this talent and let it sort of stagnate. Because Loftus-Cheek, in terms of physicality of someone that's ready for Premier League, he's been built like that since he was about 8, I think.
Yeah, that's the thing.
That's what strikes me so bizarrely.
He's the most absurd example, I think, because like you said, he is physically capable to handle the Premier League. He could handle a starting role. I mean, he did it for last season. For me, that's the thing. It's much worse worth for Loftus-Cheek than it is for Sancho and the other guys, because they're teenagers.
Look at the size of Foden.
Foden is like a little tiny, you know, he looks like a 15-year-old. I mean, he's only 18, but they're small physically, and it's like they need more time to develop into their bodies and everything. But Loftus-Cheek could physically handle a 38-game season. Now, again, you want to ask, should we give it to him? I mean, he's 21 now, 22?
22.
So he's maybe now where he should be playing regularly. And I think if I'm him, I'm saying, hey, look, mate, you don't want to play me? That's fine. Send me to Leipzig in January. That's, you know, honestly, because like he could fit right into that. There's a hole in that team where Naby Keita used to be. Julian Nagelsmann's coming in at the season. You know, that and Bundesliga is much kinder to attacking to technical talent than the Premier League is. Mm-hmm. If I'm him, I'm genuinely asking for a move. Not maybe necessarily to Bundesliga, but to anywhere. Just to get out of the Premier League, to get somewhere
that's the thing, not necessarily in the Premier League. He proved at Crystal Palace last season that he's a good Premier League player. In terms of like a match fitness of a season, he doesn't have that because he's never been allowed to do it.
Yeah,
that's what I mean. He's 22 and he's only really getting his first ever Premier League minutes, and that's what happens when someone's so good but just spends all their time not on loan or just in a youth team. He was so much better than everyone else, but the jump's big, and he wasn't given the bridge to make that jump easier. Now he's sort of in that limbo where we know he's good, but we don't know if he's Premier League ready because he's never played.
To be honest, I think he's gone down in my estimations for not pushing for a move away from Chelsea.
Yeah,
once they've once he's came back and said, okay, Sarri, you're going to play me, and he's gone out and signed two players, two new midfielders, I'd probably be saying, okay, well, that's it. It's not going to happen for me at Chelsea. It's that fear of walking away from Chelsea, I think.
Once Kovacic came in, he should have been out of the door.
That was a late move. And again, with these... If he doesn't start in the Europa League, then he needs to go in January. Because
he's going to go backwards otherwise. Yeah, he's going to look he's got into the World Cup squad, despite... Okay, yeah, he had a good loan at Crystal Palace, but he was injured quite a lot. And he's going to sort of sit on the bench for Chelsea again.
Yeah,
and then the question marks will still be... The same question marks will still be over his head.
And he's not 18, that's the thing. It's like he's getting into an age now where, as we said, like Mbappe's established... Through that pathway, Mbappe's a starter for PSG at 19 years old. Rashford plays a lot. Like, we question Rashford's thing in these minutes. And Mourinho, although he was sort of at fault for Loftus-Cheek not being initially... He gave Loftus-Cheek his debut and then nothing else. So that I found that a bit hypocritical, the fact he called him out. But ignoring that, Loftus-Cheek is older than all these players he's compared to. He desperately needs to unshackle himself now. Otherwise, as you said, all that potential is going to go down the drain.
So next up, the Champions League is back. The groups are looking very tasty. And I just want to run through which Premier League side we think will go the furthest. So first up to discuss is Manchester City.
Quarterfinals, semifinals, I think. It really depends on the draw. That's the thing. I mean, they're going to get out of their group. It's a pretty safe...
Aren't they in the statistically favourite group to produce winners?
Group F, right? Is it all winners a group from Group F or something? I can't remember.
It's like 40% of the last 15 or something.
40% of the last 15 have come from
that's
the group.
That's a
classic.
That's a really weird anomaly. But I think they'll do very well. I think they'll come out of the group. I think they'll make it past the round of 16 probably, unless they get some sort of absurd... Like the runner-up from Group D, for example, the Barcelona and Tottenham... monster group of death, you know. But otherwise, I would imagine they'll do well. But the thing is, after the round 16, it honestly just depends on the draw. It's hard to predict beyond that. Like with most teams, like I think.
But this is the thing. The way I sort of perceive it is like, again, Champions League is not a league season.
Yeah,
it's competition. So Man City as well, they still haven't shown really that they're a competition side.
It's a cup game.
So the fact that they're so dependent on who they draw. Makes me think that they're less likely to go far.
Like I said, I think quarterfinals definitely. Beyond that, it just depends on the draw.
But I think the key thing is what happens. Obviously, when does De Bruyne come back, and what do they do without him? I think, and Bernardo Silva is a really really good answer at the moment. For Portugal in the Euros, he was playing almost centrally, and I was watching him in the Euros, and I think I just. Was so jealous that Man City had this player and he hadn't been used. And then De Bruyne's injuries has given them pathway into the side. He's played right wing. He's played as a number eight, and now he's looking like one of their most talented players.
I mean, yeah, we thought it was going to be he was going to replace David Silva, and I think he still will in the long term.
It's just De Bruyne is not there.
Yeah, no, that's what I'm saying. It's funny because obviously we thought that would be the transition they make this season or next season. They'll move Silva out, bring Bernardo in, and instead it's just been Oh God, De Bruyne's injured. Oh, could you come in now, Bernardo? He's like, yeah, no problem.
Well, that's what I mean. Now they're playing two very similar players, but they're working in tandem and they look great. Obviously, Sané comes back in and with a minute scores, so he's still useful. But we sort of were right to highlight about him. Like I know Mendy was out in that game, but Delf comes in, looks really comfortable again, lets Leroy Sané play out wide.
Yeah, but
was drifting in a bit more.
That's it, isn't it?
What I mean. And Pep Guardiola, the reason they could go far in the Champions League is now he's got about four different teams that play in a completely different way, or they're all born out of the same philosophy, but they can all employ a slightly different tactical approach, which, again, that's what you want in a sort of competition, is can he now adapt to these teams? But... I expect them to walk through their group. They're so good that they should be able to do that. They've got an incredible pool of players, and I just don't. I think the fact that there are teams that are very good against them. If they get Liverpool again, they've got such a glaring weakness. It's almost like a sort of Pokemon card. No one's they're super effective against a lot of people, but one team is super effective against them. One type. So you're less likely to draw that team, but if they do get it, then they usually just lose.
Yeah, I mean, I think Bernardo Silva is huge. I think he's basically turning into the new De Bruyne. Like, you know, I think having him around is going to be massive because it just means that De Bruyne doesn't have to be rushed back from injury, which is always the thing when your best player, when one of your best players gets injured, your temptation is, okay, he's fit, quick, get him back in, get him back in. City can now afford to take their time with him because Kevin De Bruyne was the best midfielder in the Premier League, right? That's not a question. And it's like, you think, oh, they've lost him, they're going to be in trouble. And Pep Guardiola, since he's lost De Bruyne, he's played a really cool 3-5-2 formation, which doesn't need a dominant central midfielder like that. And then now he's just sort of said, okay, well, okay, Kevin's injured. Well, I'll just make Bernardo the best central midfielder in the league as well. You know, and he has done. And he has. Bernardo Silva is the best central midfielder. It looks like. It's one game. But it looks like...
The David Silva next to him is probably still better, isn't it?
Well, yes, David Silva helps a lot. But, you know, just Bernardo Silva already looks just effortlessly world-class in central midfield, which is... It's a testament to both him and to Pep Guardiola. But I think, yeah, City, I think, quarterfinals, or then more is draw-dependent.
Personally, I think they're going to go all the way.
Really? That's a bold shout.
Indeed.
I think who asked the host to talk?
I think Guardiola is going to have learned his lessons from the last couple of seasons. Yeah, obviously, they sort of threw it away against Monaco. Were blitzed by Liverpool. I'd back him to sort of figured out how to change his approach.
That's
against
what I'm saying.
Those
now
teams.
He's got a couple of little
3-5-2 and Laporte being established will help because Laporte is obviously now going to be their best defender. So that will be a big thing against the transition.
Okay, what about Liverpool?
Oh, they're going to... This is the one for me. They're going to go... Maybe not win it, but I think they'll be back to the final. I think maybe...
to the final.
I think if they draw Barcelona, Real Madrid or Juventus, these experienced sides in the semis, then maybe they won't. But I think they'll definitely make the semis. Again, unless they draw one of these three sides. There are three sides, I think, that can beat them. And not because of any tactical thing, just because they're just more experienced and more capable of navigating big European titles. I think Barcelona could beat them. Real Madrid and Juventus, because Juventus have
Barcelona
the big man.
Experience of navigating ties. Well, threw it away against Roma.
Well,
who Liverpool pumped.
That's true. That is true. But
I'm just trying to dig at you.
No. They've Barcelona certainly capable of throwing things away. But at the same time, you know, they've got Messi. Now they've got Coutinho. Now they've got Dembele. They've got those two actually embedded in. Their talent deficiency is not like it was last year. So that will help them. Madrid have just got oodles of experience even without the big man, and the big man is now at Juventus who previously had loads of experience. And so I think one of those three teams could beat Liverpool, but I think otherwise
I just think with that front three are built for, again, like Champions League is essentially when you get into knockout stages is elite competition versus elite competition. And being able to counter-attack is so valuable because you're not expected to dominate the ball. There can be games where it is 50-50 possession. So having genuinely the most prolific front three in Champions League history up front, first ever three players to score 10 goals in a season last year, beating the likes of MSN and Benzema, Bale and Ronaldo at Real Madrid. So having those three... Salah, again, so important. And although he hasn't scored a lot this season, if you look at his statistics, he's more creative this season, joint most chances created in the Premier League. Firmino's, again, we're saying if Giroud is the best sort of traditional target man, Firmino is up there in sort of like a pseudo target link man, at least not a target man but a link man. So I'm expecting him to have another really good Champions League season. And Mane, although he looks sort of a bit odd and is making those classic Mane decisions, should have given away a penalty really in that Liverpool game. He's found his goal scoring form and obviously got 10 last season as well. So Liverpool, that front three is the reason I think they'll go far, because they've got Gomez and Van Dijk now as their base. As we said, the group of midfielders they have is very balanced. They can tweak it subtly, but if worst case scenario happened and they were under the cosh, they have three incredible forward players that they can rely on, and I think they can rely on them, and I think that's why they will go the furthest out of the English teams.
I think the big question with Liverpool is how they're going to balance the Champions League and the Premier League, because let's not forget last season they could pretty much put all their eggs in the Champions League basket. Yeah. By the time the sort of knockouts came around, they just sort of coasted to the top four.
I see
them as City's main challengers for the title this season.
Yeah,
so it'll be interesting to come February, come March, and they're balancing a game where they're, you know, 3 points off going top spot in the Premier League. Let's see then how they cope with
the answers to that are Sturridge, Shaqiri, Fabinho, Henderson, Klein. That's what I mean, is although they could put the eggs in their basket, they only had one good 11 last season. They've now got five players that you can drop in and drop out, and you shouldn't be able to change the team too much. So I think they are on paper they're prepared for it. Again, as you said, in practice they could, everyone could be knackered, injuries could strike, and that, as long as that front three are fit and
managing fatigue is huge for Klopp. It always has been his Achilles heel because his style is so intense. Shaqiri and Sturridge will help, but ultimately Liverpool's team is so built around that front three that even if you're playing crunch Premier League games every weekend, it's hard to rotate two of your front three. I don't know if he'll do it. Maybe he will, and that will be huge and bold, and maybe it'll actually work out for him. I mean, Real Madrid have always had a problem managing fatigue, managing rotations. The one season they won both La Liga, the first domestic double since the 50s was 16-17, because literally they could rest Benzema, Isco and Cristiano and play James Rodriguez and Alvaro Morata. You know, so if you have trust in your backups and your backups are that productive and consistent as Madrid's were, then yeah, Liverpool could maybe handle it. But it's a question because both Sturridge and Shaqiri have always been kind of maverick players. They're not really what you would call like consistent and reliable. So let's see if Liverpool can get them rolling, then yeah, then it's going to be interesting. But Liverpool, obviously managing fatigue is a big thing. And the other thing is how they defend the space between their midfield and their defence, because that's where the big boys play football. That's where the elite teams, that's where your Pjanic is, your Dybala's, your Messi's, your Coutinho's, your Isco's, your Toni Kroos's. That's where they make their...
I didn't know there were so many Isco's.
That's where they do their business. And it's like, that's Liverpool's main weakness. Is Jordan Henderson or Wijnaldum is good, but not.
But that's what we're saying. We're saying they might have found that.
Yeah, well, it's Fabinho's going to have to come good, basically. So
those are the midfield they've got now.
Well,
that's what I mean. Just like.
Let's see. They haven't played anyone really elite yet, so let's see how they manage the space.
Okay, that's enough for Liverpool. What do we think about Manchester United?
Oh, no, that's not
Alisson. Flop! Flop to the season. They might not even get out of the group, in all honesty. They are. Really, really talented side managed by an absolute dinosaur. If they get out of the group, it'll be because they've just got lots of individual players that play well, and because Mourinho sort of accidentally stumbled into this diamond formation. You know, if Valencia could outplay them, they'll be lucky. If they get out of the group, then all right, well done. But honestly, it wouldn't surprise me if they don't get out of the group.
They've got Wonderboy coming back home as well. Who's obviously got quite a good record against them in the Champions
League. Yeah, he scored both times he's played them. I think
Juventus are a team that Man United will struggle against. Valencia are sort of under the radar in the sense that although they're struggling in La Liga at the moment, some very talented players in that squad that will cause more problems than people think. And
if Kondogbia's injury isn't too serious, then and if he's fit to play Man United, I don't know if he's going to be. Obviously, he went off the weekend injured. If he's fit to play Man United, I would back Valencia to certainly beat Man United at the Mestalla. I don't know about Old Trafford, maybe get a draw. But look, Mourinho is his old school approach to things.
But he is the thing is with Mourinho, he's a competition sort of manager. I've always said that the things I criticise him for is like a lack of a philosophy in terms of a game by game. And the reason he'd be sort of a good like national team manager, I think, is because he'd be similar to Deschamps in the fact that despite having all this individual talent, he set out a team to win games and World Cup.
I think Deschamps is better. It's Deschamps was Mourinho 10 years ago. I think you look at Mourinho, he's even sort of lost that, because if you look at Sevilla, first leg,
he literally
dropped Paul Pogba for McTominay to make a point in a knockout round against Sevilla, and he was happy to play for a 0-0 away from home. Like, and everyone knows that that's actually not a good scoreline, because the away goal then suddenly comes into play for your opponent and not for you. And it would be interesting, it'd be fun if Man United could sort of sort themselves out, because they do play a different kind of football, more defensive, and a diamond has proven successful in the Champions League recently, as Real Madrid can attest. So it would be fun if they could advance to knockout rounds and do really well, because they're just a different kind of elite team. They play a different kind of football. They're more defensive. It would just give more flavours for the knockout rounds. I don't think they will. I think if they make it to the knockout rounds, they'll get knocked out in the round of 16 or at most quarterfinals. But I think they'll struggle to make it out of the group, to be perfectly honest.
I think Alexis Sanchez's form will be entirely dependent on it. He was notoriously really good for Arsenal in the Champions League. Mm. And during his time there, he had the most goals and most assists in that competition, was topping the assist charts, despite the fact that Arsenal went out in the last 16 every year. So if he can finally find that form, I think he again came into a lot of criticism at the weekend. I think it's 3 goals in 23 games at Man United, which if you look at his record at Arsenal, that's complete contrast. So again, Lukaku's scoring. Lingard looks good in this sort of free role, but they need Alexis Sanchez to channel his inner Arsenal and come out in that Champions League stage for them to do well. Again, I was sort of devil's advocate there. I don't necessarily think they will do well, but if Mourinho is going to do well in one sort of area, I think it is in this sort of Champions League game-by-game thing. It's just whether he's lost that knack or the other teams are almost too good now. Because I think Champions League this year, again, even in Man United's group, is very tough.
Yeah, there's no favourite in the Champions League this year. I think it's wide open. So, yeah, anything could happen. But Mourinho has to... I think, honestly, the harder thing for Manchester United might even be getting out of the group. I think once they get out of the group, maybe with a bit of momentum behind them, maybe in January, maybe in the knockout rounds, they would do well. But I think getting out of the group itself, because they've got such a tough one, is actually very difficult.
Mm. And what do we think of Spurs, obviously, out in the round
of
16?
That's where I should have said the song.
Oh, Spurs are... Oh, dear me. That's a hard group, isn't it? That's not... That's literally one easy game, which is PSV at home, and that's it.
No, I don't even think that's necessarily easy.
That's a brutal group, man.
Have you seen PSV have like scored 5+ goals in their last 3 games?
No, they're a very good side. I'm just saying.
I don't think people realise how sort of attacking they are and how potent they are.
Yeah.
I know it's Eredivisie, but not everyone scores. You don't score 7 goals, 6 goals a game. You're not good.
Chucky's Lozano going to rock up to Wembley and.
Well, they've got two really
people.
Good young wingers that are going to definitely cause problems, and I think if. The amount of space they were giving sort of in between channels. Like Eric Dier looked lost against Liverpool. And if he can't anchor the same way that we were saying about Liverpool not defending that space, PSV, even if they go to Wembley or MK Dons or wherever it's going to be played in the Champions League, there will be space to exploit. And you don't want to ask Germany what Lozano can do with a bit of space to run into. So,
and you put Barcelona on that big Wembley pitch, and
Messi quite likes Wembley.
Messi likes Wembley. That's not gonna be a good time for Spurs, especially if they keep playing. This is the thing, and we all thought Spurs were going to kick on because they looked pretty tasty and everything at the start, and they smashed United, but they were really bad against Liverpool. Now I don't know if that's because international break, Harry Kane's just not firing, Dele Alli was injured, whatever. But they really looked awful. And if Liverpool are still not really playing 100% themselves, like they created loads of chances. If they were playing 100%, they would have won that game like 6-0 or something. It's, you know, Pochettino hates Barcelona, so you figure they'll be very up for those games at the very least, and he's always done well against Barcelona. But that's playing against Wembley, on playing against Messi on Wembley with all the spaces they're going to give away in between the lines. I mean, they must be praying Wanyama gets fit, like really fully fit soon. The thing is, Inter aren't exactly a rollover.
Yeah, but they've also started quite bad. Yes.
I think crucially for Spurs, they got Inter away, then Barcelona at home.
Yeah.
So they've got a chance to sort of set their stall out. If they win at Inter, then they can approach that Barca game. We'll take a point 4 and they'll be looking pretty good.
Luckily for them, Inter aren't, like Jake says, Inter aren't in good form, but... Barcelona at home. I mean, I'm really annoyed that it's not actually going to be in Milton Keynes, because Messi playing in Milton Keynes just sounds hilarious to me. But it's at Wembley, so fine. But yeah, like Jake says, Messi likes Wembley. Barcelona have won the Champions League twice there. They like that stadium. Valverde loves big games. His problems have been in smaller games against weaker opponents. Against in big games, in big stadiums, he enjoys it. He thrives there. And yeah, you just look at... It would be really, really fun to watch that battle, because Poch has always done well against Barcelona. His Espanyol teams were hilariously outgunned. They didn't necessarily win many games. They won one in the Camp Nou, but they always competed against Barcelona. They always gave Barca hell. And they pressed high and they were so ferocious and so up for it. So it's going to be really fun to watch those games, Barcelona-Spurs. But you worry with the... it's Spurs.
It's just the fact that you can't make any subs.
Yeah, and like that they've got such a small squad. They didn't add to their squad again. This is why I really can't believe... He must be so angry with Daniel Levy, because their team is great, but their squad is still so thin. Kane is not playing well, which is a problem. I mean, last year against Real Madrid, two of the big performances they had were Kane was excellent. Eriksen was not so good, but Kane and Winks, the Harrys, were absolutely excellent against Real Madrid last year when they beat Real Madrid. And Winks is just working his way up to fitness, doesn't look anywhere close to it. And Kane does...
He needs to start shooting. He's not shooting, that's the thing.
There's something wrong with Big Harry.
You mentioned about their squad not... looking too great, but they've actually got Lamella and Son coming back in. I think Lamella will probably earn himself a start, and I think Son's Champions League player.
Yeah, they're good players, but it's like that sort of when one's fit, someone else is unfit, and that sort of seems to happen with Spurs. If everyone was fit, they would have a decent bench, and they can bring on players, but he never quite seems to have it. So You're saying that it's quite a good, they can put their foot down at the start of those two games. They could also have no points from that.
Yeah, that's and what I mean. Yeah, if they go into their third game with 0 points, then it's going to be...
They won all six last year. And again, they like beat Real Madrid twice. So they can do it. They can shake off this sort of like rookie mentality.
And they've got the double header is against PSV, yeah. Which is the best thing, because you want the double header to be against a team you can beat the easiest, which I think, you know, again, Inter are, you know, they could be good, they could be bad. So, but PSV, you'd figure Spurs will have too much for them. So, and that's kind of the game where, yeah.
That's what I mean. They take 4 points in before that double header. And they then after that, they'll be looking at 10 and they'll be looking at through.
If they just beat Inter, that's huge. That alone is massive. Because even if they then lose to Barcelona, they've still got 3 points on the board. They've got a doublehead against PSV. They could come out of it with minimum 9 points. Mm-hmm. So that alone is massive. And then the Camp Nou game is the last game of the group. If they're lucky, Barcelona have already qualified by then. Take it easy. Spurs could easily go there and beat them if Barca aren't at it. So, yeah, it's...
So what do you think? I think quarters.
Yeah. I don't think they're going to go too far purely because of stretching. I think, and again, just that sort of being able to.
I think round of 16, I think they'll draw a pretty tasty. I think they'll come out of the group, they'll finish second, and I think they'll just draw someone pretty tasty, and they're like, someone too canny for again, kind of like last year where they drew Juventus and they were like they were better than you,
yeah, they should have beat Juventus,
but they turned off. They didn't know how to manage that tie, how to manage the situation, and Juve just came back and took it from them.
So next up, we've got the potential breakout players from the Champions League. And I want to know who you think is going to announce themselves and do an Mbappe.
No one's going to do an Mbappe. That guy's in, that guy. But I mean, comparatively, I think, I like Angel Correa from Atletico Madrid. I think they look pretty ropey right now. But I think by the time the knockouts come around, they'll have sorted themselves out. He's this kind of tricky number 10. He was one of the hottest prospects in Argentina when Atletico got him. And he just sort of has been sort of cooling his heels for the last 3 years, not getting minutes here and there, sort of learning Simeone's system. But he looks really in tune with it now. He's taken the number 10 shirt that Carrasco left behind. He comes off the wing. He creates. He scores. And I just think, because everyone's going to be focusing. When you play Atletico Madrid, you think, okay, I'm just going to mark Costa and mark Griezmann, and then that will be them sorted out. And I think he's going to then sort of appear in the spaces that those guys leave behind. I think he's going to do well. Also, I mean, I don't think Bernardo Silva counts because of Monaco, but Bernardo Silva is going to have a pretty big season.
Yeah, he's
as
also
well.
24. So
yeah. So I'll stick with Correa. I think Correa is going to have a breakout season.
I think the easy one to sort of be drawn to is the players that I'd pick out. We've mentioned already, so I won't touch too much on them. I think it's really easy to be drawn to someone like Jadon Sancho because Mbappe's role in that Champions League. He didn't play any of the group games and then played every knockout game. So by the time that if Dortmund do progress from their group, Jadon Sancho might have established himself as sort of a starter, and then someone with his skill and ability is always going to cause problems. It doesn't matter who you're against. So his sort of breakout season will be entirely dependent on how the group stage goes. We might see some really nice cameos from him in the group stage. And as I said, he's one of my favourite players and one of the brightest talents in the world at the moment anyway. So he's a really easy pick to make. But I genuinely think Lozano, the fact that there's going to be a lot of eyes on that group because of the players and the teams in it, just in the exact same way he did at the World Cup, this could be the one season where, or even in this group stage, if he scores a couple of goals and proves how deadly he is, how quick he is, how great at dribbling he is, if he can do that, then even in January, someone might be go. Why do we not get this guy in the summer? Mm-hmm. If he has a good group stage, he could be snapped up immediately. And then there's also Justin Kluivert at Roma, who has potential to turn some heads, being a teenage talent there. Again, I can only see him doing a sort of cameo role. But in terms of what happened with Mbappe, as I said, it was very much like, hold on, this kid is starting against Man City in the knockout stage. Oh, he scored.
Shout out Frankie de Jong as well for Ajax. Frankie de Jong and De Ligt, I don't know if he made the Europa League final, so I don't know technically.
Yeah, that's what I mean. He's the youngest ever finalist in Europe.
I think De Ligt and de Jong.
Again, all these players are sort of, everyone aware of them, but the Champions League now is going to be a very good platform for them to say, this is who I am.
Barca spent the whole summer trying to sign Frankie de Jong. I think we might actually end up seeing why. We didn't really see it for the international break because he struggled against France, but I think we might see it this season. We might see why. And there might be a few more than just one club after him next summer.
So finally, I want to finish on some quick fire predictions. And I do mean quick
one
fire,
words.
Mo.
Hey, I guarantee you, no more than three words for each answer.
So first up, dark horse.
I think Valencia.
Jadon Sancho's Dortmund.
Biggest flop.
Napoli.
Mourinho's Man United.
I fancy Bayern Munich.
Ooh.
Out of the groups and then out. Top scorer.
Ronaldo.
Cristiano Ronaldo.
Difficult to look past him, is it? Now he's broken his yeah. duck, his four game duck.
If someone that has 8 shots a game is going to score goals, like that's the thing.
Yeah, he'll back plenty.
Top assister.
Firmino.
Ooh. Crybaby Neymar.
And then finally, winner.
I think Juventus will do it. This will be it.
I think Barcelona.
That's surprising. Okay. I'm joking. Don't respond. It's a dig.
Messi says
end the podcast.
Messi says he wants to win it. That's all. That's my rationale. Normally, I would say
he wanted to win the World Cup as well.
That's true. That is true. He wanted to win the last two World Cups. Yeah. Didn't end well for him, did it? But let's see.
Okay, that's all we've got
time
for.
Wait. Who do you think is going to win?
I think Man City.
Oh yeah, you did mention that. Sorry. I'll let you finish your outro.
So that's all we've got time for. Thanks to our guest, Jake.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Mo.
My pleasure. Champions League.
And thanks to you all for joining us, and we'll catch you soon.